Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Ian MacKay's talk, A Half Century of Possessive Individualism, C.B. McPherson and the 21st Century Prospects of Liberalism. It was the keynote address at the 2014 Canadian Historical Association Annual Meeting. You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
Well, thank you very much for the honor of addressing you this morning. Our theme this year is Boundaries of Historical Inquiry, and we are encouraged by our association to reflect on the chronological, territorial, thematic, topical, and methodological boundaries of the discipline itself and its subfields. An historian like me brings to the exploration of such a task many more grievous limitations of knowledge and vision than my only two kind introducers have perhaps led you to believe. Yet I hope I have come up with a paper with some chance of provoking useful intellectual reflections within the many subdivisions of Clio's now extremely unruly and proliferous kingdom. I have chosen as my topic, perhaps somewhat counterintuitively, A Half Century of Possessive Individualism, C.B. McPherson and the 21st Century Prospects of Liberalism. In this paper, I examine the legacy of a significant political theorist of the last century, one who was both respected and vilified for his views. I say counterintuitively because some might well doubt that McPherson's works, some bearing dates from 50 or more years ago, can hold lessons for us who are not political theorists or specialists in early modern England and who live in a very different era. I want to consider not just the boundary-defying claims of McPherson's core concepts, possessive individualism and the transfer of powers, but also the boundary-challenging implications, both discouraging and encouraging, of his life and works. McPherson, I propose, is an indispensable intellectual resource for understanding the 21st century realities that are reshaping our lives, both within the university and without. His works are precious, not just because they supply eternal truths or verities. They don't really tell us the final story about the ideological history of the past 4 centuries, but because in their ambition to illuminate liberalism as a contradictory and world-changing ideology, they suggest irreplaceable insights into our own time. So in the hour or so available to me, I can only suggest these insights in summary form. If you are inclined to heed my invitation to explore these insights of McPherson in greater depth, I would encourage you to consider acquiring his recently republished classics, to read Frank Cunningham's forthcoming book, and perhaps to attend a panel about McPherson at 10:45 on Wednesday in room 105 in Shaum Tower. To the delight of some, and the discomfort of many more perhaps, a McPherson revival is underway. My thesis today is that this revival should be of great interest to historians, challenging many of the boundaries and barriers that have, in a sense, become part of our professional common sense. Crawford Grove McPherson was born in 1911 and died in 1987. He taught for almost his entire academic career at the University of Toronto, from which he graduated in 1933. He joined that university's faculty in 1935, where he, after the publication of Democracy in Alberta in 1953, he became professor of political economy. His most renowned publication was The Political Theory of Possessive Individualism, From Hobbes to Locke, 1962. But over the next 2 decades, he brought out a succession of books in political theory, including The Real World of Democracy, 1965, Democratic Theory, Essays in Retrieval, 1973, The Life and Times of Liberal Democracy, 1977, Property, Mainstream Readings and Critical Positions, 1978, Burke, 1980, and The Rise and Fall of Economic Justice in 1984. McPherson is hardly a forgotten figure. In fact, every year the Canadian Political Science Association gives its prize for the best book to a Canadian in political theory and calls it the C.B. McPherson Prize. So I'm hardly recovering a forgotten figure. And yet it would be probably safe to say that for many of us now, he has come to be regarded as a rather dated figure, a 60s intellectual, with all that that label might condescendingly apply for many people. So today, in our conference's spirit of questioning boundaries, I would like to challenge this dismissive confinement of McPherson to a past age. His ideas are, if anything, more pertinent to our time than they were to his. As a theorist warning his fellow liberals about the consequences of their embrace of capitalism, McPherson found a wide post-war audience. Yet his warnings also had a Cassandra-like quality in the ears of many of his listeners in the golden age of post-war Keynesianism, capitalism, and the welfare state. Yet now, McPherson's warnings about the risk of unrestrained markets seem extremely pertinent to our own time, perhaps even to an extent in a way that they weren't pertinent when he brought them forward in the 60s and 70s. So I think we are finding McPherson encountering a very receptive audience today, in some ways perhaps more receptive than the audience that he encountered in the 60s and 70s. So my question is, can we find in McPherson some intellectual resources useful to the critical understanding of the market logic of our own time? What can McPherson tell us about the fate of liberalism's imminent critics and about the troubled relations of liberals and Marxists? Or does the rediscovery of McPherson allow us to reflect on whether such venerable terms as liberal and Marxist, historically powerful as they are as identifiers among us, might be artifacts of the last century, slated for a revolutionary repositioning in this one? I shall proceed in three steps. In the first, I shall outline some of McPherson's key theses and say a word about the way he defended them, with special reference to possessive individualism and the transfer of powers. In the second, I shall look at the McPherson debates as they erupted in many quarters, as various critics challenged his interpretations. And in the third, I shall offer a few comments of my own on what we today might take out of this imposing intellectual legacy from the past century. So first, possessive individualism and the transfer of powers. McPherson's project, as he explained in 1976, was to, and I quote, work out a revision of liberal democratic theory in the hope of making that theory more democratic while rescuing that valuable part of the liberal tradition which is submerged when liberalism is identified as synonymous with capitalist market relations. This is very much a classic sort of way, McPherson would conceptualize his project. Throughout, he often speaks of rescuing, retrieving, salvaging, all ideas that there is something in the liberal tradition that merits recovery but is at risk of grave damage in the contemporary world. The thesis of possessive individualism became McPherson's theoretical signature. Using the gender-specific language of his day, McPherson provided a useful distillation of the core concepts of the theory, and I will just quote them to you now. And this is the theory that McPherson is really trying to draw to our attention and saying, here is what I want to critique. The first point. Man, and I'm quoting from McPherson, man, the individual, is seen as absolute natural proprietor of his own capacities, owing nothing to society for them. Man's essence is freedom to use his capacities in search of satisfactions. This freedom is limited, properly, but only by some principle of utility or utilitarian natural law, which forbids harming others. So freedom is therefore restricted to and comes to be identified with domination over things, not domination over men. The clearest form of domination over things is the relationship of ownership and possession. Freedom is therefore possession. Everyone is free, for everyone possesses at least his own capacities. So here's the first McPherson move, is to say, in early modern political theory, there was the assumption that you were the owner of your own body. From that, people would then build on a much more general idea about freedom as possession. Second, again quoting McPherson, society is seen not as it had been, as a system of relations between of domination and subordination between men and classes held together by reciprocal rights and duties, but as a lot of free, equal individuals related to each other through their possessions, that is, related as owners of their own capacities and of what they have produced and accumulated by use of those capacities. The relation of exchange, the market relation, is seen as the fundamental relation of society. Again, that's a kind of a takeaway point. The relation of exchange, the market relation, is seen as the fundamental relation of society. Finally, three, again quoting McPherson, political society is seen as a rational device for the protection of property, including capacities. Even life and liberty are considered as possessions rather than as social rights with correlative duties. So the self-proprietors at the heart of liberal theory, calculating their obligations on the basis of their self-interest, were free human beings developing their capacities. Yet McPherson faulted them on two grounds. First, that their concept of freedom was a narrow, materialistic, and distorted one. It was a concept that mistook wealth for virtue. It thereby, as Aristotle would put it, mistook the means of life for its purpose. And second, their grievous fault was that the development of their capacities entailed the net transfer of powers from other people, i.e. the extraction of wealth and power and capacity from their fellow human beings, who were denied an equal opportunity to develop fully. As he wrote in 1965, human beings are sufficiently unequal in strength and skill that if you put them into an unlimited contest for possessions, some will not only get more than others, but will get control of the means of labor to which the others must have access. So in choosing to make the essence of man the striving for possessions, we make it impossible for many men to be fully human. By defining man as an infinite appropriator, we make it impossible for many men to qualify as men. It was because capitalist social relations compromised both liberty and constituted a barrier to the development of many people that they were destructive. Thus, the two theses, possessive individualism and the transfer of powers, were tightly interrelated. It's important to emphasize throughout that McPherson is a liberal. If we follow Michael Friedan's very important morphological study of ideologies in his book Ideologies in Political Theory, in which Friedan essentially condenses his complicated theory into sort of the metaphor of how rooms are decorated and set out, and how you can sort of tell when you're in a kitchen if you can see a stove and a refrigerator. Same way you can sort of tell you're within liberalism if you see liberty is sort of front and center and other values and expectations are arranged in a peripheral arrangement around liberty. In other words, liberty in Friedan's lingo is the decontested term, the term that you have to sort of buy into or not be a liberal. A liberal who isn't interested in liberty has wandered into the wrong room. When we read Friedan's description of many of the new liberals who came to prominence in Britain at the end of the 19th century, or Sandra Den Otter's description of British idealists discovering the social in the early years of the 20th, one has the distinct impression of reading distillations of Macpherson's underlying political vision. He was, in many respects, a fin de siècle new liberal. There was a strongly idealist strain to such liberal political theorists, in conscious rejection of an older liberalism with its atomistic conception of society and laissez-faire approach to the state. These new liberals stressed how significant community was for individual freedom. They focused on the moral role of the state as a great teacher. And they focused on the various models and avenues of self-development, of moral self-development. They generally rejected traditional notions of natural rights. And rather than rejecting property outright, they sought to make it subservient to communal priorities. Macpherson took such fin de siècle liberal arguments one step further. In his thought, the right to private property was not merely demoted and marginalized, but it was also construed as one whose unlimited exercise placed liberty in peril. So Macpherson is making many references throughout his work to the work of this fin de siècle social theory, to the thoughts of T.H. Green and Leonard Hobhouse. He is championing a form of developmental democratic liberalism, some forms of which can be traced back to the thought of John Stuart Mill, in which this framework suggests that the free person should be regarded as a doer, a creator, an employer of uniquely human attributes. This is all of a piece with Edwardian idealism. So you see, the many who charge Macpherson with having been unduly swayed by interwar Marxism were by and large wide of the mark. And when they see in his development his developmental idea of democracy, a departure from liberal theory, they are really mounting an argument against John Stuart Mill as well as Macpherson. And herein lies one of the keys to why he was such a strenuously debated figure in the 60s and 70s, and I think is of great use to us today. For to an extent that discomforts Friedan and all who revere John Stuart Mill, a swing back to the older liberalism began in the 1940s, just as the Keynesian welfare state seemingly provided the technocratic fulfillment of the developmental ideal. In the mid-1970s, a new era of classical liberalism and gestation for three decades came into being. So just as F.A. Hayek was announcing in 1944 that state planning constituted the road to serfdom, the title of a book which can be found in the background of many of today's neoliberal certainties, Macpherson was developing the opposite thesis, that capitalism itself, once liberalism's loyal helpmate, had become the liberals' true enemy. We might step back a moment and reflect on what we often today mean by this polysemic word liberal. Perhaps we might agree that it often summarizes five major themes in everyday conversation. First, and very important in European intellectual history, liberal in religious life means the right to form one's own views of God and existence without secular penalties, i.e. freedom of conscience. B, in political life, it means the juridical equality of all citizens without discrimination, possessed as they are of equal civil and political rights, governed by an ethical ideal of equal respect, under the rule of law and constitutionally limited governments, to which is linked the right to pursue political and other objectives in association with others of like mind and interest. C, in personal life, we mean, in a sense, liberal to mean generosity and kindness, a warm sense of humanity, combined with an appreciation of human diversity, extending to tolerance of different ways of life and value systems, i.e. liberality, a word that is often brought into context with liberalism. D, in intellectual life, we We mean creativity and curiosity, the right to freely pursue inquiries of one's own design without coercion and without fear, perhaps through projects in the liberal arts, all those intellectual and artistic pursuits not directly attached to technical or professional training, within which one's individuality is enriched and horizons are broadened. And E, in economic life, we mean the right to private property, especially private property in the means of wealth creation, and support for free enterprise, often with the expectation that the free market, with minimal regulation, can largely work to the benefit of all. Hayek's take on this body of ideas, drawing centrally upon the theories of Herbert Spencer, one of the tradition's great luminaries of the 19th century, who brought liberals the assurance that their views were underwritten by the latest word in evolutionary theory, Hayek argues that item E outweighs all the others. Free enterprise is the fundamental and core principle to which his liberalism is loyal. Indeed, the pursuit of the other objectives, if they are allowed to go too far or to draw attention away from the primary emphasis on free enterprise, might indeed overpower, overwhelm, betray the liberal tradition. Hayek is not betraying the liberal tradition. He is channeling its very powerful pre-1840s and then Spencerian current in a way that now we are living with every day. On the other hand, McPherson's point is that E, the free enterprise point, the individual's right to private property in the means of wealth production, it is this point that has over time come to overpower all the others. Such respect for property rights was undeniably an element of the great tradition constructed out of the ideas of Locke and Adam Smith and Edmund Burke. But especially after the advent of democratic forms of government, generally in Europe in the 1870s, it had revealed itself to be an obstacle to the free development of human beings. Any conception of liberty as mere physical non-interference and of property as an adjacent concept propping up self-determination has to be challenged. So you have this kind of complete schism in the ranks of liberalism. As a child of T.H. Green, Leonard Hobhouse, and R.H. Taney, McPherson viewed liberalism as an evolving doctrine, one that had outgrown the capitalist social relations within which it had first developed. He saw liberalism as threatened at its very core by those who insisted upon the primacy of capitalist social relations and the transfer of powers they entailed. If McPherson's house was, to my eye, plainly a new liberal house, laid out with all the expected rooms and accessories, one should also notice that this house was located high upon a mountaintop, where the view was clear and the air thin and pure. There is this distinctive atmosphere in the house of McPherson. Such McPherson classics as Possessive Individualism and Democracy, Essays in Retrieval, are almost clinical in the way they inspect political theories. The text in question is ushered into the room, placed upon the operating table, and then slowly and remorselessly, a scalpel-wielding Dr. McPherson lays bare its contradictions. And here, disagreeing with those who would make McPherson over into some kind of Hegelian, when we say expose their contradictions, we mean that McPherson wants to, in essence, untangle their logical problems. A contradiction here has a very different sense than it would have in a Hegelian Marxist reading of history. It's really just the sense of a contradiction in ordinary talk, of you're contradicting yourself, your argument is self-contradictory. That is the sense in which, that is the world in which McPherson is working. In the overwhelmingly idealistic atmosphere of the McPherson corpus, one examines the logical problems of Locke or the inconsistencies of Burke rather in the spirit of pointing out problems for the solution of a mathematical equation. So a classic instance of this comes when McPherson takes on Isaiah Berlin's concept of the two concepts of liberty. Still a very favorite text among many undergraduates in political theory and history, in which negative liberty is basically the freedom to be left alone by the government. Positive liberty is the government's your ability to develop, often with the government's assistance. The McPherson response to this important contribution to neoliberal theory was to parse what Berlin means by liberty, take it apart immaculately, so that at the very end of the day, while the whole tone of the discussion is that he's trying to help poor Isaiah out of a small logical befuddlement, actually he has, in essence, completely demolished Berlin's theory. If you have any students who are tempted by negative positive liberty things, this is a great text to send them to. And another way in which McPherson is extraordinarily our contemporary. You could almost imagine reading McPherson that someone, say the president of ExxonMobil, who had unwittingly inherited the mantle of possessive individualism, would, upon reading of its inconsistencies and fallacies, would instantly cease and desist and adopt another frame of reference. There's an incredible belief here in the power of logic, of truth, almost a Voltairean respect for a disembodied sense of ideas that can tell us enormous amounts about reality. So reading McPherson is a bracing workout for the mind, but it's also a workout that taking place at a very high level of abstraction. Into the House of McPherson are welcomed a series of liberal luminaries, treated almost as our contemporary co-explorers of modernity. It is less clear that the House of McPherson would prove equally congenial to those who did not share his formidable intelligence or cultural background. Instead, as in the case, indeed, of John Stuart Mill, there is a distinctly aristocratic atmosphere at the top of this mountaintop, as when we hear McPherson muse that workers subjected to mindless work were naturally apt to become somewhat mindless themselves. There's very good reason, when you're looking at McPherson, to insert him in a context, a 60s context of the new left, of participatory democracy, of new notions of community development, all these things that are coming on so powerfully in the 60s and early 70s. But we should never do so at the cost of overlooking his Victorian and Edwardian sensibilities, both of the thinkers that so strongly influenced him, and then with McPherson himself. If the context in which McPherson developed his theory was in some respects that of fin de siècle new liberalism, adapted to the contingencies of the Great Depression, the context within which his most widely read books were received was that of the Cold War. In the U.S., as such historians as Wendy Wall have reminded us, the death of ideology, the consensus view of history, the disdain of all explanations emphasizing the intrinsic contradictions of capitalism, all these were actively combated and demolished in a self-aware PR offensive. It was an incredibly vigorous, well-orchestrated PR offensive to persuade Americans themselves and all North Americans that we enjoyed the American way of life built around consensual values, and to stray outside that consensus was to indulge in moral peril. So the irony here is that themes of McPherson's that really wouldn't have raised that many eyebrows in the Edwardian period would have been regarded as kind of interesting progressive ideas, suddenly became intensely controversial and even perceived as starkly subversive in the 1950s and 1960s. McPherson hardly ingratiated himself to Cold War liberals by bringing out The Real World of Democracy in 1965, the printed version of a series of radio lectures. "We in the West," he proclaimed, "are gradually realizing the West no longer has a monopoly of civilization or world leadership. We in the West have built up a system which we value very highly. It combines a large measure of individual liberty with a fair approximation to a majority rule. None of the other systems have managed it, and we don't intend to be talked out of our achievement, no matter how necessary a policy of coexistence with other systems may be. So far, so very, very liberal, one might say. And yet McPherson went on to discuss two other non-liberal forms of democracy, those of communism and those of many states in Africa and Asia. McPherson thought that these regimes, too, had cause to call themselves democratic, insofar as they, quote, were moving towards a firmly held goal of an equal society in which everybody can be fully human. So altogether, there were three forms that made up the real world of democracy. And when all three concepts of democracy are seen in perspective, quoting McPherson, they have one thing in common. Their ultimate goal is the same: to provide the condition for the full and free development of the essential human capacities of all the members of the society. So in its context, McPherson's book is a plea for détente and a recognition of the dignity and complexity of the decolonizing states in Africa and Asia. And note, even in this popular work, that McPherson's founder, Siecle Liberalism, is up and running, in that it is the concepts of democracy and not living and breathing Democrats who are going to be doing all the work and who are realizing this ultimate goal. So even in this very popular CBC presentation, the concepts are almost endowed with a life of their own. And this text concludes with a popularized and very accessible statement of McPherson's core argument. And I quote, "The dilemma has been that if we allow freedom to naturally unequal individuals, we are in fact denying equal freedom and humanity to all but the stronger and more skillful. For to allow freedom of enterprise and of acquisition has been to deny access to the means of labor, that is, to deny equal access to the means of a fully human life. The choice had to be made between freedom, along with the denial of full humanity to all but the stronger and more skilled, or denial of freedom in the interests of more equal chances of humanity. The liberal capitalist society chose freedom and denial of full humanity. The choice no longer has to be made. It had to be made only while scarcity was king." So McPherson foresaw a time when the accumulation of wealth would no longer be of high social importance. He was paraphrasing John Maynard Keynes. And there would thus arrive a change in the code of morals. Indeed, the time had arrived when we, i.e. we in the West, should discard the morality of scarcity. For by discarding it, and only by discarding it, can we resolve the contradictions implicit in the market concept of freedom and in the market concept of the human essence, concepts built into the liberal democratic justifying theory. We can then hope to retrieve the democratic values of equal freedom and equal access to a rational purpose of life. It was a gross misinterpretation to imagine the Keynes quoting McPherson, who placed Soviet democracy on a far lower level than either its Western or Third World counterparts, and who imagined that all of liberal society could be united undividedly in making one philosophical decision. It was a gross misinterpretation to see him as a kind of proto-communist. Yet gross misinterpretation came with the territory in the era of the Cold War. He had diverged from the script of Cold War liberalism simply by admitting the regimes outside the West were pursuing objectives, some of which could be aligned with John Stuart Mill's developmental script. And he diverged even more sharply when, alongside such consensual-sounding phrases as "we in the West," he made reference to that old idea of the transfer of powers, with its implication that deep divisions were in fact endemic to capitalism and endured as menaces to liberty. So all the furnishings in the real world of democracy still seem liberal and would hardly have been out of place in the world of Leonard Hobhouse. And yet, something about it was profoundly unsettling in its context. Ideas that might have been merely progressive 60 years before were now deeply troubling. So now let me move on now to the McPherson debates, which ensued really after the publication of Possessive Individualism. It is worth remembering when reflecting on McPherson's trajectory in the 1960s and 1970s that some of the most brutal, the fiercest conflicts of the Cold War took place in the manor houses and cornfields of 17th century England. The course of the heretic was rarely an easy one, as everyone who then started to work on the rise of capitalism in England discovered. And even less easy would be the course of a liberal heretic who had taken it upon himself to dissect the foundations of his own doctrine. In the context of a Cold War in which unqualified admiration of those foundations was the sine qua non of being a loyal supporter of the consensus. There was a fascinating element of moral panic in the fervor with which McPherson was misconstrued and then attacked in the 1960s. Cold War polarization undoubtedly played its part, but so too did McPherson's unsettlingly liminal status. He was plainly one of us for fellow liberals in his culture, his formidable familiarity with the liberal tradition's founding fathers, and yet he was so plainly not one of us in demanding that the liberty at the core of liberalism be rethought, and believing that there was something amiss with private property in the means of life. Here was a genteel, formidably scholarly, quite unflappable and seemingly reasonable person who, having read the great and good of the liberal tradition, still seemed convinced that it had cracks in its foundations. Often, rather than undermining his interpretations, his foes preferred to question the judgment of the scholar putting them forward. From Peter Laslett to William Lees, McPherson's liberal critics treated him as a stealth Marxist. Keith Thomas considered McPherson an orthodox, albeit subtle, Marxist, who applied a simplistic base and superstructure analysis to Thomas Hobbes. Peter Laslett considered McPherson a dogmatic economic sociologist of a familiar but refined Marxist cast. And Laslett would go on to write in his introduction to Locke's Two Treatises of Government that McPherson wrote, and I quote, "from a point of view which scorns petty bourgeois socialism," thus directly implying, without evidence, McPherson's direct kinship with the values and methods of the authors of the Communist Manifesto. In such academic put-downs, many of which today seem abusive and pointless, one can nonetheless find something of interest. They were foreshadowings of the much more militantly policed neoliberalism of our own time. You can feel the boundaries of correct opinion being drawn in the McPherson debates. The social liberalism of Hobhouse and Hobson, Green and Tawney, Dewey and Lasky, this social liberalism, which was once conventional wisdom with a wide swath of the informed public in the Anglosphere, was now becoming suspect. A sea change in liberal ideology was happening in the confines of a historiographical discussion. At a much higher level of abstraction, yet not unrelated to these polemics, were the methodological critiques emanating from the Cambridge School of Political Theory, with which Peter Laslett, John Donne, J.G.A. Pocock, Keith Thomas, and Quentin Skinner are all associated. And many such critiques, McPherson was brought forward as a model of how history should not be written. Skinner, in some respects the most philosophically ambitious and talented of them all, argued, and I draw upon James Tully's fine précis, that, quote, "to understand a text, it is necessary to understand it as a complex of linguistic actions, and thus to recover what the author was doing in writing it, the author's point or force, by placing it in its convention-governed linguistic context." And as this school takes shape as it gains hegemony in large measure in the field of the writing of political history, it became a major taboo to go beyond textual interpretations that placed each text in its convention-governed linguistic context. Well worth reading is Skinner's 1969 polemic on this question, worth reading if only for its brio, but also for its keen and sharp intelligence. 5 years later, in 1974, McPherson had become Skinner's exhibit A of bad historical practice. His attempt to write the history of possessive individualism, I quote, involved an unhistorical level of abstraction. And Skinner then generalized, the key to excluding unhistorical meanings must lie in limiting our range of descriptions of any given text to those which the author himself might in principle have avowed. And he adds, the key to understanding the actual historical meaning of a text must lie in recovering the complex intentions of the author in writing it. Feel the boundary coming in, that now the entire discussion of an author, a text, an ideological tradition, if it is to be correct, if it has to be based on a truthful and accurate rendition of the meaning of a text, must lie in the recovery of the complex intentions of the author writing it. There are many things to be said, pro and con Skinner's position, and this textualist approach that became dominant with the Cambridge School, and many others have said them with great facility. I think with respect to the interpretation of specific texts, there's a lot to be said for it. I think an extraordinary example from our own time can be seen in Lars Lee's Benin's Rediscovered, What is to be Done in Context of 2006, in which Lee looks at Lenin's famous text and essentially demolishes the textbook Lenin that people had assumed must have written the text. Rather than accepting this textbook Cold War Lenin, this incipient totalitarian who disparaged trade unionism, believed in a vanguard party imposing its will from above, Lee painstakingly reconstructs Lenin's text in its particular context. He looks at it as a particular argument designed to accomplish specific objectives in a determinate context. He closely analyzes Lenin's rhetorical strategies and takes careful note of the intricate cut and thrust of particular debates, so that in the end one cannot but come away with the sense that the common Cold War rendition of Lenin's text, having failed to place it in its convention-governed linguistic context, is simply mistaken. Rather than trying to build a party of a new type with ominously dictatorial features, Lenin, under Karl Kautsky's influence, was in 1902 trying to replicate in Russia the achievements of German social democracy. So a vast library of denunciatory books came into question. So I would advise you to look at Lee on Lenin as an excellent example of textualism put to extremely fine, I would even say brilliant work, one that will make you think afresh about Lenin, about the communist tradition, about everything you thought you knew about the Bolsheviks. So clearly, I think in a certain context and in a certain way, Skinner and the textualists had a point. The very close examination of a text in its particular context can tell a surprising and very enriching things. Yet, as many critics have pointed out, once textualism was exalted from being one interesting way of looking at text and into an entire philosophy of history, it turned into a program that entailed a dramatic drawing in of history's boundaries. In particular, textualism tendency has been, and here I quote Joseph Femia, to treat ideas from the past as purely historical phenomena, forever locked in their determinate context. So those liberals who applauded the skewering of McPherson, the supposed Marxist, were perhaps unaware that the new methodology also ruled out any form of historical interpretation predicated on a distinction between the manifest and latent content of a body of thought. Farewell, then, not just to C.B. McPherson, but also to Leo Strauss and Benedetto Croce, and a veritable library of celebrators of the liberal tradition. Temea remarks, what is dead in the thought of our ancestors must always be presumed to outweigh the part which is living. But the Asauristus need not operate on the facile assumption that past ideas are entirely and inextricably bound up in a straitjacket of particular circumstances, particular questions, and particular intentions. The substantial risk posed by Skinnerism was that of treating every historical utterance and action as a unique event. And in that case, historical inquiry becomes well nigh impossible. For if all historical events are sui generis, then we cannot write history. We can only pile up the documents. There was a relationship between the low-level liberal resistance to Macpherson on account of his imaginary communism and the high-level theoretical resistance to Macpherson's critical dialogue with the founding fathers of English liberalism. For both responses went back emphatically to individualistic strategies that they perceived Macpherson had placed at risk. In the first case, one responded to Macpherson because one wanted to save souls from the road to serfdom. And in the second case, one wanted to save the freestanding and intentional author of his or her own text from the burdens of being attached to a tradition spanning decades and centuries. In neither case was it easy to see beyond the boundaries of the individual case to the more general social and ideological processes at work in that individual's choices, which is precisely what Macpherson was attempting to accomplish in possessive individualism. There was a certain grim irony in the anti-Macpherson attacks by the apostles of textualism, who had gone on at such lengths about the need to respect the intentions of authors, yet proved so remarkably slipshod in their approach to the intentions of Macpherson. They tended to read into Macpherson an unproven Marxist intentionality, often completely disregarding, as they did so, the very things Macpherson himself wanted to do with words. And within that framework, within that tradition, Macpherson's heresy still remains scandalous. It is amusing, if only in a bleak sort of way, that in the presumably authoritative Rutledge 4-volume Guide to Liberal Thought, edited by G.W. Smith, we find a tendentious critique titled The Macpherson Version, but no words directly from Macpherson himself. He is silenced in the four volumes of Collection on Liberal Theory. Macpherson was often taxed with reading into early modern England things that could not have existed, a capitalism that could not have been there. His critics often like to dwell upon the ridiculous idea that Hobbes was fully capitalist. Given his early modern context, it wasn't going to happen. They seized upon every instance they could of the complexity and the contradictoriness of a given thinker, that thinker's groundedness in a given context. And yet, in all of this, they were fundamentally misreading Macpherson's intentions. And none of this actually really bore on Macpherson's thesis. It was not really anything pertinent to Macpherson's thesis to write the biographies of the early modern and modern figures that he wrote about. So it was sufficient for Macpherson's thesis that elements of possessive individualism could be found within the thoughts of the people that he discussed, on the assumption that this worldview was over decades and centuries consolidating itself and becoming ever more powerful. So in the same way that one could take Lenin's What Is to Be Done and say that it does not seem preposterous to say that text, though it must, as Lee argues, must be read in its context and all of its richness and vitality. You will not get all of the text if you don't have that context and the strategies of the author. It's also not unreasonable to situate that text in the longer-run version of the history of communism, where the text is brought to work, put different readings, interpreted in different ways, and so on and so forth. Many liberal critics thought they had defeated Macpherson by demonstrating that one or another of the thinkers he studied was a far more complicated person, than any such focus on his thinking about property allowed. Hobbes was far more religious. Locke was far more interested in promoting the rights of working people. Burke was far more sincere in his perceptions of society as an organic unity. But none of these refutations actually succeeded, because they imposed upon Macpherson a biographical intention foreign to his project. And almost none of his liberal critics, one must say, engaged constructively with his work. Liberals denounced Macpherson as the Marxist he wasn't. Marxists flourishing in the academy in the 1970s and 1980s critiqued Macpherson as the liberal idealist he was, but who for some reason had translated Marxist ideas into his own liberal language. Marxists got into the habit of exposing the individualism in Macpherson's writings. Historian Paul Axelrod recalled a moment at a student conference at Glendon College at which Macpherson critiqued capitalism, but then went on to defend, and I quote, academic freedom in the university as a liberal gift that should not be abused. Following Macpherson's presentation, recalls Axelrod, one of the student radicals approached Macpherson, shook his fist in his face, and announced, "We are going to get you." On a much higher plane of abstraction, historian Ellen Meeksens Wood condemned Macpherson for having been seduced by the liberal tradition and argued that he did not grasp liberalism and capitalism were interrelated. One could hardly rescue the first without incorporating aspects of the second. Leo Panitch reproved Macpherson for borrowing concepts from Marxism without taking responsibility, and it's an interesting point. He borrows the concepts from Marxism without taking responsibility for the development of Marxism itself. And he generally agreed with Wood that Macpherson's strategy amounted to one of, quote, educating the ruling class into socialism. Thus, Macpherson, in many Marxist critiques, was too liberal. He seemingly wanted to deploy some of the analytical tools of the Marxist tradition, translated into a liberal language, to make the world safe for liberal individuals. And many others picked up in his Edwardian idealism, the ethereal quality of many of Macpherson's discussions. They also noticed his skepticism about the working class, his self-confessed inability to sympathize with all of the intricacies of Marxist economics, and so on. Well, such Marxist critics were, in my estimation, not wide of the mark, certainly not as wide as their Cambridge predecessors. An amusing 1976 exchange with Victor Svajic, who had written an article on Macpherson's philosophy that concluded that Macpherson was perhaps five-sixths the Marxist, albeit an elusive one, five-sixths the Marxist. Macpherson replied very gently in, I think, a correction of the young scholar's math. He said, well, that one's work can be taken seriously both by a guardian of liberal theory and by an activist Marxist is very encouraging. But then he went on to explain that he disagreed with the Marxists on such trifling matters as revolution, the dialectic, the potential of the working class, the significance of one Karl Marx's Capital. In other words, I think if you're taking a Frieden look at this, a morphological look, remember, with the rooms, the ideological rooms with the various appliances and appointments, I think a Marxist looking at the appointments of the house of Macpherson was apt to come away rather disappointed. You can only imagine Marxist interior designers descending upon this mansion and concluding it called out for an extreme makeover. Dominic Lacerdo, whose recent critical remarks about Macpherson reveal, I think, mainly that he's working from a faulty translation, notes nonetheless in his ruthless exposé of the liberal tradition further themes that are missing or underplayed in Macpherson on liberalism. Where do we find any acknowledgement of liberalism's global tendency to draw a boundary between the free and the unfree? Or a full acknowledgement that on much of the planet, liberalism, which was born alongside the racialized chattel slavery of which Locke and Calhoun were such distinguished theorists and practitioners, that liberalism performed a role as the great de-emancipator throughout the planet? And where, Jessica Pitts might also ask, was John Stuart Mill's defense of the Opium Wars in China. So within a Cambridge-inflected liberal historiography, McPherson had become the bad example of an historian who falsely attributed intentions to people in the past and misconstrued their context. And among Marxists, and also among post-Marxists, he was the bad example of an old humanist, a pre-theoretical innocent. Only some scholars and leftists persisted after the 1980s in citing McPherson as an authority or an inspiration. So here's one reason to explore the case of C.B. McPherson, and it is to get a sense of the intellectual changes that are going on throughout the North Atlantic world from the 1940s to the 1960s, and the way in which the boundaries around true liberal belief, the liberal ideology that is immensely powerful in this world, these boundaries are becoming more and more constrictive. When ruled out of court in this new environment, the questions that McPherson had raised about property, individualism, and capitalism. There was once a time in the third quarter of the 20th century when activists and intellectuals confronted the iron certainties of the Cold War with risky ventures into no man's land. That big no man's land between the ideological juggernauts. In many creative ways, they sought to bring to life new ways of combining liberty and equality, experiments that found in McPherson's Real World of Democracy a subtle and lucid manifesto. This was the heyday of the Anglo-Marxists, the Euro-Communists, Salvador Allende, and Yugoslavian self-management. It was the day of the recovery of Antonio Gramsci and the first stirrings of cultural studies, enthusiasts for many of which currents could be found in Professor McPherson's extremely influential seminar room at U of T. It was a time of community development, participatory democracy, power to the people. And it was the era in which McPherson could find many critical and thoughtful liberals responding positively to a central message that in order to preserve the freedoms they cherished, they would have to sever their traditions' links with a crisis-ridden and greed-inducing capitalism. A message, let us remember, that could even be delivered on the CBC. And then came the neoliberal passive revolution, that process of rule from above, through which an oppositional tendency is selectively de-radicalized and absorbed by means both subtle and rough. This revolution did not seem so very passive on the streets of Santiago. Here was the moment of neoliberalism, to which McPherson, late in his academic life, applied some of his most brilliant critical energies. So you can see this moment of McPherson as a sense of the world that we lost when this 1970s moment of neoliberalism started to cohere. Perhaps we can all enumerate the ways that neoliberalism has changed our world and our own everyday lives. But do not overlook the extent to which it is within political theory and political philosophy, it has essentially rewritten the entire universe, closing down what we might call the moment of McPherson. To a startling extent, McPherson's homeland, the realm of political theory, became in the 1970s, throughout North America, a sphere transformed into one in which the inevitability and goodness of liberalism was propounded with a theological certitude. The procedural liberalism of John Rawls, which had the effect of making political theory seem a branch of moral philosophy. Or the theory of Robert Nozick, who sanctified the very property rights that McPherson wanted to boot out of the liberal tradition. These had the effect of rendering liberalism both timeless and unassailable. Any historicization of liberalism's key assumptions, let alone diagnoses of flaws in its underlying foundations, came to seem heretical. So the overwhelming liberal cast of political theory, and by extension, the entire academy, was accompanied by its stern lack of historical realism. I find it interesting that the new Cambridge companion to Locke lists no fewer than 57 references to God, 34 references to morality, but zero references to slavery. This is a dramatic drawing in of the boundaries of acceptable belief, and is of a piece with what happened throughout the politics of the West, where one's voting choices are mainly confined to selecting among a number of liberal parties, only distinguishable from each other by the militancy with which they espouse very similar market solutions. So here's one reason to explore the role of McPherson, is to re-experience for yourself what we went through in the third quarter of the 20th century. A foreshadowing of the ideological certainties and restricted boundaries of our own time. The locus classicus of the treatment of McPherson in a contemporary period, the dismissive treatment within the Liberal Academy, can come from William Leese's book, C.B. McPherson, Dilemmas of Liberalism and Socialism, first brought out in 1988, reprinted as recently as 2008. And at least you have the vivid sense of why visit McPherson. For at least, why visit McPherson is really the same reason you go to East Germany and go to the DDR Museum. You want to sort of experience the shabby, sad, sorrowful realities of a completely discredited and discarded social form. So it's almost like Professor Leese is ushering you through the museum of McPhersoniana, just as the travel guide says, here's the Trabant that they used to drive around in East Berlin. There is a stern tone in Leese of McPherson is strictly a person of the past. He is a person who cannot budge from his old certainties, caught in Leese's reading and the certainties of 1930s socialism. He's strangely unaffected by anything else that happens around him. He has to cling to these certainties with adamantine rigidity. It is a stirring polemic. And one wonders if, like many a former radical en route to greener pastures, Leese is in rubbishing McPherson, atoning for his own radical sins of omission and commission. Actually, once Leese himself had cited McPherson favorably in the way that he had brought life to the critique of what Leese himself called bourgeois society. But now we have a McPherson that is basically useless to us, according to Leese. In a very arresting passage, he calls upon his students and readers to watch out for this trickster character. Leese writes that McPherson is like a critic who appears at an intersection and climbs atop the signpost affixed there, where arrows point in two directions, at right angles to each other. Weary travelers arrive at the same crossroads along a route they know, whereupon the critic atop the signpost says, "Do not continue to make your way along the familiar path. Choose an entirely new one instead." And when following the critic's gesture, they turn their gaze 90 degrees to look toward the promised land, they find themselves staring not at an unfamiliar but pleasant-looking vista through which a smooth trail wends its way, but instead an unbroken wall of dense, dank undergrowth riddled with thorns, lacking entirely any point of entry. Heed not the trickster, Leese urges us. Brave not the undergrowth, but stop and smell the flowers. For we should relax and realize that most of the old debates that once energized geezers like McPherson are now passé. Actually, we all realize, do we not, that patterns of the few benefiting at the expense of the many are fast fading away. Why even contemplate the wonders of the new third way that has brought us well-managed economies? Look at the market, the heart, very heart and soul of an emergent social type that is here to stay forever. Look at the world's thriving 24 quasi-market societies, Leith urges us, with Ireland and Iceland sharing the honors with Japan and the United States. Look at our steadily rising living standards. Look at the West's well-accepted social programs. Why, then, should anyone want to plunge into the undergrowth? Well, let me wrap up with offering a few Gramscian perspectives on the McPherson trajectory. It is a precept of the historicism that underlies my reflections today that contemporary critical scholars are called upon to analyze not just the historical reasons underlying other thought forms, but also to reflect rigorously upon the nature of their own frameworks, thus becoming aware not only of their framework's historical constitution, but also of the ways it might conceivably be revitalized. There's a high degree of reflexivity in this vision of historicism. Such a perspective also calls upon scholars and activists to bear in mind, and I quote, the always practical nature of thought as an instance of the active attempt to organize or modify social activity as a whole. Here I am quoting from Peter Thomas's path-breaking The Gramscian Moment. So having spent the first section of this talk outlining McPherson's core ideas, and the second describing the debates which flowed around them, I conclude with some reflections on why and how critical scholars today might access some of his seemingly long vanquished theses. For McPherson is being revisited today, along with Carl Polanyi, R.H. Taney, and a host of other liminal figures from the liberal socialist dialogues early in the 20th century. And the questions that McPherson asked about property are ones that many people in today's ever more unequally divided world are also asking. At a time when human extinction can be seriously contemplated as a possibility by the scientific community, it is difficult to locate within the various currents of left anti-humanism fashionable in the academy grounds upon which this impending catastrophe might be critiqued and averted. Would not the global planning regime necessary to respond to global climate change require a biopolitics and a governmentality and a moral regulation, indeed on a world scale? The recovery of left humanist voices from the 20th century is perhaps an indication of a general discontent with a state of left theory, so good at the analysis of the Enlightenment's many sins, so feeble in suggesting any positive alternatives to our present crisis. Possessive individualism as a critical thesis about the logic of liberal order suggested that through intense meditation upon foundational texts, liberals could become aware of their philosophy's constitution and imagine ways it might be revitalized. In his book of Essays and Documents on Property, 1978, McPherson imagined just such a revitalization. What if instead of schemes of abolishing property, we explored the idea of property as, quote, a right not to be excluded by others from the use or benefit of something? If we changed our fundamental conception of property, McPherson urged, then all the property forms that flowed from that conception, new various and multifarious as they would be, would nonetheless have to encompass a governing social logic, one very closely aligned with that of R.H. Taney, which said that property must be contingent upon service. The property forms then would have to be extraordinarily revised, revolutionized, and on a liberal basis. So far as I know, the ideas remain mainly a utopian one, without any clear working out of how such new concepts of property might be instantiated. But when I read it, I thought to myself, there is a new, fresh idea in a time when all of our boundaries have become so constrictive, when properties become a complete common sense of our time, when possessive individualism has seized not just early modern thinkers, but an entire culture. I read in those words of McPherson a promising indication that one could perhaps use some of his insights to rethink a fundamental idea of our political order. McPherson saw property, so to speak, as a philosophical event. Even to treat it in this way was provocative, because it had the effect of transforming a thing into a process, a common sense into a problem. The sobering implication of his analysis for us today is that if this core issue is avoided, democracy will continue to deteriorate. The analysis of Thomas Piketty, documenting the extent to which inequality has grown dramatically over the last decades, has been conjoined to the most modest of proposals to avert this tendency's acceleration. But notice the derision with which these very modest tax proposals are arousing in the bien-pensant general public. McPherson asked the key question that Piketty, in a sense, avoids, and that is, should we not rethink property to its foundations? Can we not imagine a new forms of property that preserve the planet? Can we not, as new liberals of Hobhouse and Hobson's generation would have said, make property strictly subservient to human development? An old impulse from the fin de siècle that in ours seems a proposal both impossible and urgent. The next left will arise out of the smoldering ruins of the great 20th century citadels that once bore the names liberalism and socialism. And its architects will need to consider carefully what of enduring value is to be rescued, transformed, and redeployed in this century from the ideological fortresses of the last century. In the opinion of McPherson, the challenge lying before those loyal to the legacy of J.S. Mill was to use the insights of historical materialism to persuade their fellow liberals to sever long-standing links with possessive individualism, that property-centered ethos that arose alongside their political theory in the 17th century. It was a message that only some could hear, and it lacked a feasible scheme of implementation. Yet in reply to Lease, this form of concrete utopianism has its value in identifying with great clarity the obstacles for a rational future. And one of McPherson's enormous attractions today is that as a thorough and sincere liberal, he anticipated the ways in which the old citadels will have to be transformed and replaced with something entirely new. Jeff Eli, in A Crooked Line, From Cultural History to the History of Society in 2007, told us that he decided to become an historian, quote, because history really mattered. It was necessary for making a difference. He went on to say that, quote, history is nothing if not sutured to a pedagogy, to a political ethics, and to a belief in the future. A safe history confined within its conventional boundaries risks having an entirely predictable future, one provided by the market, in this case, the market in positions and jobs and postgraduate fellowships and prestige, all of them now becoming commodities. The pedagogy, political ethics, and the future such a strategy pretends in what is one in which critical historiography, after a tumultuous youth, matures into acceptance of the world as it is. History then becomes the ideologue's repository of tendentious analogies, or the snob's fund of refined references telling of his or her cultural capital, or the ever-abundant source of the History Channel's entertainments. And even in this highly attenuated form, the craft of history is imperiled, because as good deans and university presidents will not hesitate to tell you, the cash flow generated by our history departments is a lot less impressive than that of the average science lab, not to speak of the average business college. To an extent, McPherson would have been found interesting and also troubling. It is amazing how completely possessive individualism, the very cultural form that he analyzed with such persistence and with such controversy, has taken over our universities. The liberty that we enjoy within our universities is increasingly contingent upon our willingness to make ourselves and our colleagues over into paying propositions. And a key attribute of our age is that any sense of sanctuary from market forces is vanishing. So middle-class people who once might have considered themselves insulated from capitalism's stark capacity to reduce human beings to mere commodities have been taught otherwise. Remember McPherson's comment from earlier in the lecture, the market concept of human nature. That is the human nature with which we often deal in today's academic world. It was Lisa's bad luck that he ended his assault on McPherson with such warm praise for quasi-market economies like those of Ireland and Iceland, victims of the world financial crisis of 2008. Yet it is unfortunately true that the liberal possessive individualism diagnosed by McPherson did not succumb, as was never likely to be the case, to the power of his logic. He sensed in the 1960s that liberals like himself were called upon to reflect on capitalism as a barrier to human flourishing. But today, we might well wonder if possessive individualism does not pose a more direct menace to human survival. Can atmospheric CO2 levels higher than those seen for thousands of years be grasped without an analysis of capitalism? And can capitalism be analyzed without an understanding both of its logic of accumulation and its now formidable means of securing hegemony, so often by conscripting such fine old words as freedom and individuality? Can its pervasiveness as a structure, not just of accumulation, but of faith, be grasped without a comprehension of the ways in which its conjugation of freedom and property has become an unexamined common sense of our own time? Of course, Lise had a point about McPherson. Atop his signpost, Lise does not beckon travelers toward a clear political path. There is a quality of utopianism in him, one traceable back to the turn-of-the-century theorists he found so inspirational. Yet if we use this word of utopianism in its more common pejorative sense, that of irrealism, one submits that the greater lack of realism can be found on the part of Lise. What if, as 95% of the world's leading climate scientists are suggesting, Lise's comfortable path leads straight into an abyss? What if the daunting task of plunging into the undergrowth, into all the contradictions bequeathed to us by four centuries of possessive individualism, what if that daunting task is the only one that is realistic in our time and in our space? What if the abyss can only be avoided if we enter the undergrowth? These are historical questions. They address dilemmas hundreds of years in the making. But coming up with answers to them will necessarily involve not merely the discipline of history, but all the human and natural sciences, including political theory, political philosophy, and political criticism. Liberals still inspired by Mill's On Liberty and its respect for individuality are called upon by the neoliberal world to grasp that Mill's concept of the freely developing individual is now one that is decisively undermined by the market forces he played no small part in calling into being. If they genuinely share with Gramsci and Mill a warm appreciation of the value of each single individual, one that in the former case extended to colonized and racial individuals as well, it behooves them to acknowledge that many such individuals are being extinguished by institutions and movements directly descended from their liberal ancestors, and deploying many of those ancestors' categories. They must, in short, attain to a concept of history as a contradictory process in which they themselves are active terms, a mission that requires, as C.B. McPherson so brilliantly demonstrated a half century ago, a detailed re-examination and critique of the entire tradition of possessive individualism. In a sense, in a strong sense, liberals must become Marxists, and Marxists must become liberals, and then, united in new activist and intellectual formations, work to change the History Channel.
You've been listening to a recording of Ian MacKay's talk, A Half Century of Possessive Individualism, C.B. McPherson and the 21st Century Prospects of Liberalism. It was the keynote address at the 2014 Canadian Historical Association Annual Meeting. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.